This is The New Yorker Out Loud. I'm Amy Davidson. In 1972, Jean McConville, a widowed mother of 10 living in Belfast, was abducted from her home in front of her children and never seen again. It's now clear that she was murdered by members of the Irish Republican Army, who had accused her of being an informant for the British. It was one of the most notorious cases in a period known as the Troubles. Last April, more than 40 years later, Gerry Adams, president of the political party Sinn Féin, was arrested and questioned for 4 days about his role in the murder. Upon his release, Adams, who maintains his innocence, had this to say.
The past is the past. The future is about children. The future is about grandchildren. The future is about the rights of citizens to live in an Ireland in which everybody can be comfortable. So don't let anyone rob our people, all of our people, of that right. We need equality and we need justice for everyone.
Justice can be elusive in Northern Ireland and in any region recovering from conflict. Patrick Radden Keefe writes about Jean McConville's murder and Northern Ireland's tenuous peace. He joins me, along with staff writer Philip Gurevich, whose upcoming book, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know, is about life in post-genocide Rwanda. Patrick, let's start with Gerry Adams, who embodies a lot of the tensions in Northern Ireland. He helped negotiate the Good Friday Peace Accords and helped to get the IRA to give up its guns. He's always said that he wasn't one of the men with guns himself, though plenty of former IRA members have named him as a commander and someone who ordered violent acts. He's in Parliament now. What does it say about the state of Northern Ireland that his past is such a point of contention?
It's a fascinating moment for Northern Ireland. I think that there's been a tendency, at least in the U.S., to think of the Troubles as having been resolved with the Good Friday agreements and the various sides giving up their guns and the introduction of a kind of a formal peace. I was really shocked when I spent time in Belfast for this story to find a society that's still really profoundly divided and in which some of the terrible things that have happened in the past stubbornly refuse to stay in the past. When you go and knock on doors there and ask about something that happened in 1972, a look of alarm will cross the features of the people you're asking, and for them it's as though it happened yesterday. And with Adams, he as you say, kind of embodies this irony. Somebody I spoke to when I was doing this said that in some ways it's a story about a bunch of people who have trouble sleeping at night because of all the things that they did, and Gerry always looks as though he's had a good night's sleep.
Philip, this isn't just an Irish problem. Leaders with a past seem common in post-conflict situations. You've written a lot about Rwanda. When you're trying to assemble a government following a crisis like this, did you see also that, you know, there was a certain amount of cognitive dissonance or even willful blindness that was inevitable?
The fact is, you don't make peace with your friends and allies. You make peace with and have to try to, quote-unquote, reconcile with your most mortal enemies. That's where the process has to happen. And that requires various maneuvers that allow you to deal with people who previously you were willing to fight and kill and die for prevailing against. And it invariably means that neither side has prevailed totally if they have to talk to each other. And so you get into this murky situation then where there's an incentive to decontaminate, in a sense, the atmosphere in which the political deal is made. But that's very different from the process then of living with this past. You can't really have reconciliation. You can't forgive somebody who doesn't acknowledge and ask for pardon. Acknowledge the fault.
Can't you, though? Can't you? Is it possible to silently forgive or to forgive in mutual forgetfulness? Or do you think it really is the case that for there to be forgiveness, there has to be full acknowledgement?
Full acknowledgement is such a debatable term. Some acknowledgement. For it to be a kind of social or political forgiveness, as opposed to letting go or an individual saying, you know, I'm not bearing a grudge, I'm not going to poison myself, that's a private matter between an individual and another. But in terms of this sort of historical process, there has to be the sense that they're now living inside the same story.
One thing that I encountered in Belfast was this question of where the danger lies. you would often hear when people start digging into the past, and you actually you could hear it in those remarks that, of Adams that we heard earlier. It's a frequent refrain of his. Anytime people start pushing too hard to delve into the past, he'll talk about the fragility, the great fragility of the peace process. And if we start asking too many questions about the past, what you might do is you might upset the peace. It's interesting because on the one hand, that's a kind of compelling and seductive way of looking at things. On the other hand, I talked to other people who said that if you really examine that kind of a statement, it can begin to sound like a threat, right?
Oh, very much.
We wouldn't want things to go back to the way they used to be. But I just wondered as a general principle, I mean, I think you can look at it the other way too, which is if you don't have, not necessarily accountability, but some accounting of what happened, that what you end up doing is sublimating and suppressing in a way that could only be temporary these hostilities and that they might fester and potentially explode down the road.
There's no perfectly satisfactory formula for balancing the wish for justice, the wish for peace, the wish for a reconciliation of the historical record that would lead to some kind of broader social reconciliation, and making room within all of that for the necessary passage of time and generations. How I forgive the killer of my father. I can forgive him, as somebody said to me in Rwanda, for what he did to me by killing my father. But for me to do it for what he did to my father is in a sense, a betrayal of my relationship to my father, for me to reconcile with that
right.
person. And that creates a tension that eases with time, ideally.
Let's take a break here for a word from our sponsor.
Kone is the first music player that thinks. It listens to your requests, picks up on your habits, and learns your tastes to create the perfect soundtrack for any moment. From the moment it's out of the box, Kone starts getting to know you, which songs you love and which you don't. Whether you want to listen to Bach or Springsteen on a Thursday night, Kone even learns that when you're in your kitchen, you prefer to hear the news. Kone gives you free access to RDO's library of over 30 million songs, plus thousands of internet radio stations and podcasts through Stitcher. There's a lot out there to love, and Kone helps you discover it. To learn more, visit www.ether.com. That's AETHER.com.
You know, we've talked a lot about the IRA, but well, how about how the British look back on it and the things the British Army might have done that people on that side might not be proud of?
One argument that Adams and some of his supporters make now about the Jean McConville case is, look, if we wanted to have a kind of full and robust process in which we really dug up all the bodies and really inspected what everybody did during this time, then that would be one thing. But you're kind of cherry-picking a little bit. And I think that's very much the case. Personally, I'm not all that persuaded by Adams' suggestion that, you know, he would welcome a process in which we really looked into absolutely everything. I think it has a kind of rhetorical force in the context of the Jean McConville case, but I don't know that if you actually introduced such a process, he would really welcome it.
This is the political argument. We're in a better place now. And these are painful ghosts. Let the stuff stay buried is the view of most politicians.
I think that he's doing something very subtle because I actually think for a lot of his supporters, not least in the United States, there is that perception of him as a hard man. And he may not say it, but there are these kind of winking allusions. And I do think for and I say this also having grown up in an Irish neighborhood in Boston, but for a certain segment of Irish America, it's not that Gerry Adams was ever Nelson Mandela. What people sometimes describe as the whiff of cordite about him was always part of what made him such an alluring figure.
Americans have a funny relationship to the IRA, given our normal talk about terrorism and terrorists.
There's a kind of interesting place where there was a kind of romance of that struggle that was tied in with Irish identity here and the idea that sometimes you got to do some hard things to get where you need to go, and this kind of classic struggle rhetoric.
Our double thinking as Americans during the trouble might have been, you know, romance of the IRA and the romance of Charles and Diana and loving them and loving things British.
Right. We could keep these two ideas in our minds simultaneously.
We're very good at that. Philip, what does the long run mean in these cases? You know, the idea that in the long run, you know, the pain will go away somewhat or the anger. Is it years, decades, generations?
You know, we're all told to never forget this and never forget that. And we've made a kind of fetish of memory in modern times. But the difference between memory and grudge is often pretty hard to tell. And most of the great atrocities have been committed in the name of some memory. Primo Levi famously titled his book about the aftermath of World War II. He called it The Truce. And he really saw the periods between wars as no more normal than the periods of war. That sort of one oscillates between these things. So obviously when you're 40, 50 years, several generations into a period of relative stability, and the memory of these things gets pretty attenuated and historical, you know, you can start to feel like things are pretty stable. But oddly, when there's the next conflict of whatever kind in a given society, it often immediately draws on echoes and strains from the last.
I mean, think of Milosevic, right? Think of a field in Kosovo. Right? I mean, you can get these kind of highly opportunistic contemporary political moves in which you can use these apparently dormant conflicts and grievances to galvanize people in a truly frightening way. I mean, they can assume an incredible momentum.
The Crusades and the Caliphates,
or, you know, those Boston Irish had a traumatic memory of the potato famine.
Well, right, except that there, and I mean, I guess this is the reason I mentioned Milosevic, there's always a degree of kind of contemporary manipulation of the past, right? I mean, the hard thing in terms of the, for instance, the American supporters of the IRA is that a great deal of history has passed. There are all kinds of discontinuities between whatever experiences drove their families to emigrate in the 19th century and the contemporary reality in the 1980s or 1990s, where the IRA was still engaged in the struggle, but there were also aspects. I mean, the IRA was also robbing banks at this time, right? There were, you see this in a whole bunch of contexts. We see it right now in the Middle East, but in which diasporic populations kind of keep supporting the good fight from whatever luxurious position they're in, where they don't actually understand the toll that fight is taking on people, you know, actually on the ground.
And when all stories get carried to other countries, other decades, it's all the more important to get the story that's happening on the ground and the story of reconciliation out there.
But the flip side of that, too, though, I mean, it's interesting. We talked about romanticizing these conflicts and how that's easy to do if you're in the diaspora and you can do it from a geographic distance. But there's a kind of temporal aspect to that, too. I talked to an American who had been involved in the kind of diplomatic process in Northern Ireland. And what I said was, I was asking this question about the long run and saying, can we at least think that perhaps the children, the new generation growing up with the internet, growing up in a city where bombs aren't going off all the time, will essentially kind of shrug off all of this stuff? And he said, oh, on the contrary. I think that the older generation remembers how bad it actually was. And the problem is that the kids growing up today in relative peace are more prone to accept these kinds of divisions because in some ways they haven't sort of seen the human toll, the human cost that can come when they really blow up. I mean, it was a deeply depressing observation when you think about it.
I mean, that, I guess, is another argument against silence.
But it's certainly true that, you know, you look around the world and going in any major society, go more than a couple, like two or three generations without a war is unusual.
Yeah.
Part of that is that people have forgotten how terrible it is. Or they think they see something differently, or they're, you know, there's this sort of renewal of the combative spirit or the energy or the idea that we can move this thing forward through violence. And often, as there was in Northern Ireland when these troubles began, there's also an ingredient of real grinding poverty of a certain kind. There's an underlying element of desperation, the feeling that you don't have a lot to lose.
Right. Though, listen, I mean, there's another way of looking at this. What Adams and others would say, and I think they're right, is that particularly through the 50s and 60s, it was just axiomatic that if you were a Catholic in Northern Ireland during that period of time, your prospects were much more bleak than if you were Protestant. And a lot of those conditions don't pertain today.
So he might argue that the violence paid off.
Yeah.
Would argue.
Sure.
That you're welcome.
The violence, let's remember, that he says he was never a part of. All right. Then we get into one of those historical circles. So maybe that's a place to wrap it up for now. Thank you guys so much, Patrick and Philip.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Patrick Radden Keefe and Philip Gurevich are both New Yorker staff writers. You can read Patrick's piece about Northern Ireland in the magazine. You can subscribe to The New Yorker Out Loud and other free New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes store. If you're already a magazine subscriber, you have free access to the magazine's app for tablets and smartphones.